Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Fidelis Club. This is a show where we cover the news from around the world, and we get people from, around the world to tell us what's been happening in their country. We do this roughly every month, and we are supported by Patreon, or by the listeners who support us on Patreon. If you want to support us, you can go to patreon.com/thefidelisclub and become a patron. That would be incredibly highly appreciated. So my name is Patrick Béja. As many of you know, I'm sure, I am from France originally, but I currently live in Finland and have been for a few years. And today we have two guests that I'm incredibly happy to have on the show, because we're going to be talking about topics I've mentioned a few times in previous shows. And really, I have no idea what I'm talking about when I do. And they actually do, because they're from there. Please welcome to the show in your car or in the bus. Clap as I am to welcome Irina and Hannah. Irina is originally from Russia, and she currently lives in Prague. So thank you very much for being on, Irina.
Oh, thank you for inviting, Patrick.
I'm so glad that we can finally get someone from Russia. To be honest, I've been trying to get someone for a long time, and it's not easy. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But first, let me welcome also Hannah, who's joining us from Belarus. Hello, Hannah. How are you doing?
Hello, I'm fine. Thank you. How are you?
I am a little bit stressed because we're going to be covering topics that are not so fun, I think, but we're going to try to do it with the usual lightheartedness, if we can, that we have on the show. So I'm going to tell listeners already, I don't think we're going to be talking a lot about what's happening in France and Finland. It's COVID and lockdowns, and that's what's been happening for the past year. So you already know all of this. So I'd much rather focus on what's happening in Belarus and Russia. And before we do, maybe I can ask both of you to introduce yourselves and to tell us a little bit about yourselves so we have a bit of context. Irina Lagunina, is that the right pronunciation?
More or less.
More or less. All right, I'll take it. Thank you for being kind. So can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I work for Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, which is an American international broadcaster. Well, not that much a broadcaster anymore with internet and social media, of course, but we kept the name Radio just because it's a huge history of 70 years of broadcasting. And that's what I'm doing for the last 25 years, for the quarter of a century. But before that, I was a journalist in the Soviet Union, actually, and in Russia. That's it. That's what I can say.
Already, I have a million questions coming to my mind. The first two, and we'll go to Hannah before we start, we launch into the full conversation about Russia. But the first two questions I have are, a journalist in the Soviet Union, how does that even work? And the second question is, so the radio that you are working at now is an American radio station, which immediately I think is going to... Because on this show, we often try to get all the opinions, even the ones I vehemently disagree with. And then it's like, yes, but there's always bias. So I'm sure you, when you talk about Russia, people might ask, well, you're the money comes from the US. So aren't you biased in against, you know, maybe not against Russia, but yeah, that's the first couple of questions.
Well, you know what, the journalist in the Soviet Union, I was lucky because I actually went into journalism at the end of the existence of the Soviet Union. So the censorship was not that bad already. That was Gorbachev times. Mm. And that was the first experience of more or less free press. I actually experienced myself censorship only once. Which was really bad. I was covering the earthquake, the devastating earthquake in Armenia in 1987. And I wrote an article on how the humanitarian aid was stolen and was not reaching the areas that were completely, that just evaporated from Earth because of this earthquake. And my editor-in-chief actually called me and asked me to come to his office and told me that he consulted with the Communist Party Commission on Censorship, and they said that all humanitarian aid is reaching those who needed it. And I said that, you know what, then let's just not publish the article, which was the case. We didn't publish it. But that was the only time when I really felt and experienced censorship in the Soviet Union. Otherwise, it was a great time of, opening the archives, exploring the new topics like Stalin's repressions and, all this that came with perestroika in the Soviet Union and then actually helped to this country to finally, this monster, communist monster, to finally collapse. Which is not the case anymore. I mean, the archives that were opening at that time are now closed again.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. What you're describing seems like I don't know firsthand the situation in Russia now, but it seems pretty clear that it was more free for the press at the end of communist Russia than it has become in the past, 5 years or few years under Putin. It's worse now.
Exactly. And, it was a great time because on one hand, there was a lot of freedom already. But on the other hand, there was no financial or, different political interests yet in media. So we were all very poor, but very happy.
That sounds like, from the little I know about Russia, even during communist times, well, maybe not very happy, but making the best out of what we have, out of what you have, seems like the Russian, ingrained in the Russian psyche. When I went to Russia a couple of times, I saw, this is a completely different topic of conversation, and it's terrible. I do this all the time, but there were great parks, and my wife, who knows about Russia a lot more, was saying, you would have the philosophy of the Russian people shown through when the writing, and even in communist times, you would have people in the parks and, playing guitars. And of course, things were terrible. But when you say we were poor, but we were happy, somehow that sounds like Russian endurance. But I don't know. Maybe that's the image I have, which is not accurate.
Well, it's not the case anymore.
So. Yeah, right. okay, so the other question I had was about being financed by the U.S. Doesn't that set an agenda or have some kind of bias? I don't think so, but I have to ask what you think about that.
No, Radio Free Europe is kind of a strange media because we are completely different from like Voice of America or BBC or Deutsche Welle. All the international media, international foreign broadcasters have a specific task to represent their countries. It's in the charter of BBC, for example, or in the law that describes the work of Voice of America. It is the Voice of America. So those radio stations or TV stations are tasked to represent their governments. Radio Free Europe is completely different because it talks about Russia from within Russia. The same with like our Belarus service. It talks about Belarus from within Belarus. So we are non-governmental. We have a firewall, which is the bipartisan board of directors that actually exists to protect us from the political influence of whoever is in the White House in Washington or in Senate. So it's slightly different. I wouldn't say that I'm biased in covering Russia, since I'm Russian. I mean, I have Russian passport, and I'm biased in the fact that I want the best for Russia, of course, and I'm biased in the fact that I always try to support those who do not have access to media, who do not have platform to express their opinions, and this category, unfortunately, is growing in Russia. There are more and more people who cannot have their voice heard. So if you can say that this is biased, that's it.
You know, that's... Yeah, we're going to talk about it a little bit more, but I think that's a key aspect of any kind of journalism these days, and maybe it's newer to us in the West, but there's this idea that you have to be that you always have to show both sides, and I'm a little bit guilty of this because I try to go and talk to people I disagree with all the time, and you know, they're usually normal people. They're not politicians or anything. So we usually find that we have a lot more in common in humans, but even if our ideas are very opposed, as people know on the show, I've talked to people who are pro-Brexit or who are pro-Trump, and I definitely disagree with them. Especially in those camps, there's this idea that you're being discriminated against because the media is not presenting kind of both sides equally, when really sometimes and often when you get into those issues, both sides aren't equal. And we're going to get back to this in the case of Russia and what's been happening with Putin and Navalny and all of that. But before that, Hannah has been very quiet. Thank you for indulging us. Could you also give us a little bit of context and tell us who you are?
Sure. So my name is Hannah Lybakova. I'm a journalist from Belarus, and I'm a non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council. I also used to work at RFERL, and I totally can relate to what Irina was saying. I do believe, and I'm confident that RFERL is impartial. I used to work for the Belarus service. I was based both in Belarus and in the Czech Republic in Prague. And we did not fight the Belarusian state propaganda with propaganda, because that's not how that pro-Lukashenko, pro-Russian even propaganda can be defeated. Instead, we promoted democratic values. And that's what was the main goal of it, right? To kind of show the value that a free press could provide. And in Belarus, I must say that there is not so many ways how independent media could exist. So it kind of has to be funded in a way by foreign governments or whatever, you know, foreign business or whatever can fund a media outlet. Because, well, in Belarus, it's strictly controlled, and the state doesn't allow independent media to be sustainable, basically.
When did Lukashenko arrive in office? It was early 2000s, right?
Oh, that's too optimistic. No, it's 1994. Oh.
Okay, so it was essentially after the dust settled from the breakup of the Soviet Union. he arrived in office, mm-hmm. and from was it from the get-go that the Free Press was essentially muzzled?
It was basically, yes. It's kind of, it happened since the, when he arrived in office, when he became president, and he immediately understood that he just needs to take control over media, over the parliament, and basically over different institutions, over the high court, for example. Like, he just kind of knew that that's how he would stay in power longer. Yeah. And it's just kind of surprises me how come that a former farm director was so sure and kind of confident what he should do, you know, immediately, because he just we used to have obviously the independent parliament, which we don't have anymore. It's totally controlled, and all these kind of MPs, right, they are being carefully selected, and no opposition MP is now in the parliament at all. The kind of courts, the judicial system is totally controlled, media is controlled, so it's just kind of the system he has built for all these 26, 27 years, in a way, is perfect in terms of how a dictator, an authoritarian leader could build a system that just kind of exists for basically him, right? For the sake of him being in power.
Okay. We're going to talk about what's happening now, but again, just for a little bit of context, he was elected, wasn't he? He was democratically mm-hmm. elected?
So 1994, 3 years after the official resolution of the Soviet Union, there is this first election, and he was elected. And it was the second, like the last time when we had a free and fair election in Belarus.
All right. And we'll get to the unrest that's happening now after 26, 27 years. But let's go back to Russia and let's talk about what's happening now. And somehow that sounds similar to the image I have of the path that Putin took. And I'll tell you my understanding of the situation in Russia, Irina, and you can tell me where I'm wrong. But my impression about Putin is that initially the country wanted stability and wanted someone who was less corrupt and who wasn't a drunk, essentially. Sorry if I'm being dismissive, but that's my impression, that the country actually elected Putin, maybe not fairly, but that even if you had fair elections, he would have come in power, and he was he had a high rate of approval, a genuine high rate of approval, even with all the controversies he created and the genuinely worrying things that were happening. And over the past, I don't know, I would say 5 or 6 years, maybe this is a little bit fuzzy, he actually started turning the country into more and more of a totalitarian regime, to the point that now the government controls a large part. It's not 100%, but a large part of the judicial, of, well, I guess, everything. And the opposition has also dwindled because he has quashed everything. And I talk about opposition because, of course, we get to Alexei Navalny, who was arrested. He is the main face of the opposition that is left, and he's managed things incredibly cleverly, including on social media. And he evaded, well, he was lucky and didn't die when there was the assassination attempt last year, was it? And he was treated in Germany, which I think everyone knows. But what's been happening now in the past few weeks and months is that he was arrested when he came back, and there's this completely ridiculous trial where he had been accused of something that doesn't really even matter a few years ago, and he's being accused of having broken his parole and not having been in court when he should have been, when he was essentially on the deathbed in Germany because of the poisoning that the Russian government had done. And now he's being sent to a maximum security prison. It doesn't even do it justice to say maximum security prison. It's an internment camp, essentially, probably. We don't even know where he is. And through all this, he's managed the communication very cleverly, and there has been protests. But what can you do? It's not like... And this is where we are. This is my understanding. Now, what is accurate and what is wrong, Irina?
Okay, let me start with the beginning. I think that what is not accurate is that all those draconian changes in Russia happened in the last 5 or 6 years. Mm. No, actually, I absolutely agree with Hannah. And I can draw the same picture of the Russian regime as she was talking about Lukashenko, because once Putin came to power 21 years ago, he actually started to turn the country into something different than it was before him. And it happened gradually. He is very smart. It happened gradually. It happened with... first eliminating the possibility of political parties to participate in the parliament, for example, or to even get to the parliament. He actually
That's a big deal. How do you even do that? That is the most anti-democratic thing you can do. How do you even do that while keeping the image of some semblance of democracy?
You just put the proportion of votes higher, for example. There are 86 regions in Russia, so you have to have a certain representation in each and every region. You have to get a certain number of supporters in each and every region. And Russia is a vast country. So for small political parties, it's just impossible to get a certain number of voters in each and every region. But if you put it in the law, then automatically this party will not get to the parliament.
So and it's kind of voter suppression and kind of gerrymandering on a very large scale.
Exactly. Yeah, okay. And what he did also, he first took control over electronic media. And there was a little bit of a weird situation when all the electronic media, except for one radio station, was under state control, and internet and print media at that time was relatively free. So you had this idiotic picture of two Russias existing at the same time. One is the Russia of electronic propaganda, and the other is the Russia of print media. But that's not the case, because he also gradually moved to control the print media as well. Mm. So, and now there is a huge push to control even more internet. Internet was poorly controlled, I think, because the regime actually used it a lot. And they didn't want to slow down internet or to shut down social media, because they used it as a propaganda tool as well. I mean, through all the armies of trolls, false messages, false narratives, they spread their message pretty successfully, I would say, through social media and internet, as well as through state-controlled television. So that's why they didn't kind of slow down internet. But it looks like right now they lost confidence in themselves of how they can use internet. So there is a push to slow down Twitter, to take control over social media like Facebook and YouTube. We'll see what's going to happen, but the tendency is not good right now, and all the moves that they're making are not good. Little by little, they did establish the dictatorship state right now. So when they were telling that Lukashenko is the last dictator in Europe, I don't think that it's true anymore. Not the last.
So you, if when I say that it's my impression is that Putin did have genuine support in if you go throughout Russia, would you say that that's actually not the case, or is it because of the way the voting was manipulated, or is it true but it has, you know, since then the situation has become so bad that it has it's not the case anymore?
Well, I think it's still the case. No, I think that he has genuine support of maybe not 74-76%, but over 50, I would say. And I also, there is now the new generation that grew up with him. They didn't know any other system. They didn't know any other president. Those are people who are 20, 21 years old, and they are pretty much accustomed to have this kind of stability on one hand, on the top of the government, but relative freedom of, once again, traveling and internet on the other hand. We see this descent of this generation right now because I think, and that's my personal opinion, because I think that the corrupt practices of the state actually contradict with the relative freedom that this generation was brought up in. And they don't see that many opportunities for themselves in the country because primarily of the corruption of the regime. So that's why they are protesting, and that's why actually Navalny's supporters are so young. The state was concerned. There were protests that erupted after Navalny returned to Moscow and was arrested after Germany. And there were pretty big protests for Russia right now in late January and February. Early February, and the state was concerned that there will be a lot of school pupils, actually, that would go out in the streets. Well, not that many, but if you look at the faces of protest right now, they are very young.
Right, so it's people who are coming up and who represent something that Putin hasn't had, or the increase of the support of that part of the population he hasn't had to deal with before. Maybe, do you think that's why they're trying to slow down the internet as well, to kind of make it less visible how things are in, I don't know, that sounds like I'm talking about Soviet Russia, but to make it less easy to see how things are in other countries so that people aren't as likely to, you know, refuse what's happening in their country? Or is it just that they don't want the communication to happen?
No, I think that it's not about the other countries because, you know, when you go to Russia and you spend like 2 weeks there, you don't know what's going on in the world at all. You don't see the real picture. It's just completely virtual reality that they create through television primarily. But in terms of internet, you know, it's the same that... We were talking before the internet became so popular in Russia. We were talking about how do we reach Russia like better? Can we get like a satellite TV? And the problem with all this is that Russia is self-sufficient and Russians are self-sufficient. They don't read or watch something in foreign languages. You need to talk to them in Russian language, and they don't make an effort to get like a satellite dish in order to get something. They take what they have in front of them.
So what's the image of the outside world in Russia? What's that virtual reality? What does it look like when you're in Russia?
First of all, you don't really know the news that are going on in the world, or you see them, but they're kind of strange. Like, for example, right now, well, I had a funny story with my parents. once I got a call from a mother who was very concerned and asked me, oh, is it really that bad? I said, Mom, what exactly do you mean by that bad? Oh, the television is saying that you have huge demonstrations. Really? Where? About what? And mother said, well, it's anti-COVID protesters that are crashing. And so then I switched on Russian TV and saw that they were showing something, but the signs were in Latin, but like you have an exclamation sign at the beginning and an exclamation sign at the end. And that's Spanish. Mm-hmm. But that was attributed to Czech Republic.
Really?
So that's how it's made. I mean, it's total manipulation. I'm just telling you the technique of how they do it. Mm. So that's how you see the world. But the problem is not in what they show. The problem is in Russian self-identification. You know, if there was a recent Levada poll, and this is the only independent pollist in Russia, they asked if Russians feel themselves Europeans. And to my horror, majority, actually 2/3, said that no, they don't feel themselves Europeans. And most people who didn't feel themselves European and who didn't think that Russia is a part of Europe were young people.
Wow.
Those who are over 55 were kind of more inclined to say that they are Europeans and that Russia is a part of Europe, not the youth. And that's scary.
Mm. All right. That we could talk about this forever. I do want to get to Navalny, though, and what's happening now. He was arrested under those ridiculous charges. I mean, they're legal because that's what the system said, but clearly they're made up, or I guess not made up. The original one was made up. Let's not even go there. And they're using this to justify everything that's happened since. And let's, you know, just not even mention the fact that the government tried to kill him. Do you think it's Putin who tried to do it, or was it someone who was overzealous in his, you know, military apparatus? Or do you think he gave the order? I don't know if that's something we can even speculate on.
Well, it's difficult to speculate because you don't know who gave the order, but it's definitely made on the highest level. It's impossible without, state control over this poisoning.
Mm. So this doesn't happen if the highest level isn't aware of it. It's not someone who takes that decision.
Absolutely. And this is all very close the circle of Putin. I mean, there, the circle is not that wide. So, and it's mostly so-called law enforcement or security services. So, I mean, it's all one circle. You cannot separate Putin and say that, well, he gave the order or his friend gave the order. It doesn't really matter. It's the system that allows something like this to happen and that actually does it itself. So whether it's Putin or his best friend, it doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter, All right,
frankly, it just doesn't matter.
So, thankfully, Navalny survived, and he made the incredibly brave decision to go back to Russia, where he knew he was going to get arrested. He had a whole social media campaign prepared, which it could have sparked the protests even without it, but it certainly seemed like that was very cleverly done. And there were gigantic protests for weeks. And when I say protests, again, my impression is that if you take Moscow and St. Petersburg, then you have a very different picture of Russia. When you were saying the country is very, very large, like it goes all the way to Asia, and you have, I don't know, rural entire regions that are look very different from the main cities. But the protests were happening even in remote areas, so that felt different. And again, that's my picture of it. You can tell me if I'm correct or not, but I'm not sure where it can even go. Like, are the protests continuing? What's the country feeling about Navalny? What's happening now?
Well, right now, Navalny team and Navalny himself called not to go to demonstrations because of the weather conditions, epidemics, COVID, a lot of factors. But actually yesterday, Navalny team called for new protests in spring. They didn't announce the exact date or even week when this happens, but they announced that they will study the public opinion, whether people think that they should continue with protests. And they opened this special website where people can leave their opinion if they think that the protests should go on and will bring some change eventually.
And the government is leaving the site up because they could block the IP or something. Are they leaving those up?
Yes. Frankly, I cannot say right now because the site opened yesterday. And immediately crashed.
Right.
And we were trying to understand why it crashed. Maybe because so many people went in there immediately and just the system couldn't absorb so many users at the same time, or was it some sort of attack? So we'll see what happens. It just happened yesterday. So
okay.
It's very, very young. It's not that easy to block the sites. I have to say,
okay.
Especially if there are cloud sites.
Okay. So, yeah, so what's the situation now? Like, what is, I guess no one can speak to Navalny anymore. So his team and his wife, I'm guessing, are managing the social network and the internet activity. But looking at it from here, it seems like, well, he's in prison for at least 2.5 years, if he even, you know, survives. And he's going to go out at some point, and maybe he's not. But for now, it's looking like, looking at it from here, you can't really do anything. Unless maybe they can protest more in the spring, and that can bring stuff. But what do you think can happen?
Well, Navalny has this idea, which is pretty smart, actually, of smart voting. And actually allowed in several cities during the last municipal elections, allowed independent candidates to go to the local power, local authorities. Which was an interesting development in Russia. And
just to explain, the smart voting thing, for those who aren't aware, it's making sure that everyone votes for the one person who has the most chances to be elected, no matter who they are, as long as they're not the you know, Putin's party's representative, correct?
Exactly. And it doesn't matter whether they're communists or nationalists or liberals or whatever. Several independent candidates actually got because of the system. And taking into consideration that Navalny really has a lot of support outside, as you rightly pointed out, outside Moscow and St. Petersburg, because during the last presidential elections, he campaigned all around Russia. I mean, he was traveling. He had this Western type of campaign, almost American type of campaign, where candidate would go to certain region and meet with people and talk to them and you know, try to get their concerns and problems. So that's what Navalny did. It was actually fascinating to watch it. So he has a lot of support on outside in Russian provinces. And if his idea of smart vote voting will reach the provinces, then I think he is trying to change Russia from the bottom, not from the top. It will take a long time, but maybe something will get out of it.
Okay. Yeah, it seems like it's not an immediate uprisal and then Putin sees fire in the street and has to resign or anything like that. It doesn't seem like that's possible. All right. We can keep talking about Russia, of course, but I do want to go to Belarus for a second. So, Hanna, thank you so much for being patient. I'm sure that what we've been talking about sounds a little bit familiar, but at the same time, it seems like Lukashenko's dictatorship is more traditional, or that's the impression I have. And the protests now, because of course, for those who don't know, there have been protests for the past few weeks. I don't know what the state is right now, but how are things evolving, and is that a similar situation with what's happening in Russia, or how would you describe it?
Well, I think the when protests started in Russia, they were often compared to the situation in Belarus. I think the main difference is that in Belarus we have the revolution. Like it's been happening for more than 220 days. Since the 9th of August, basically, and in Russia, as Irina already explained, that looks a little bit different. We also thought, many people thought in Belarus that it would be faster, it would be quicker, but well, as I kind of tried to explain before, Lukashenko has built a perfect system that sadly functions well. So it's not really easy to kind of, you know, force him to step down so quickly. Nevertheless, people continue protesting. And the level of repression has been incredible, just unbelievable for Belarus. Since August, there have been more than 30,000 people arrested. And it's just a country of 9.5 million, so that's a high number. Mm. There have been now nearly 300 political prisoners recognized by human rights defenders organizations in Belarus, and there are more than 2,000 criminal cases that have been started. So we might end up with even more political prisoners eventually. So I don't know to what extent you are aware of what happened in August and in the month after August, but that so was like the. Mm-hmm.
So I'm a little bit aware, but I do want you to explain, because it will make things easier. I do have a question before that, though, kind of a mm-hmm. similar question to what I was asking Irina. My understanding of Lukashenko is that even with the 27 years of, dictatorship, there was some measure of support because things were stable, and things changed mm-hmm. more recently, or at least, you know, people were a little bit resigned, or I don't know how to describe it exactly, but my impression is that, you know, it was a dictator, but some people, at least a large part of the population, was, well, at least, you know, it's things aren't burning all around us. Is that fair, or was he never popular?
Well, he was popular. That's obvious. He was elected in the first place. There were
right.
Years
I mean, more recently, yeah.
There were years when he was more popular, and there were years when he, like, people did not really like him. So it was kind of, you know, there were waves of support. I would say that in the past decade, his support decreased immensely. The last, well, it's really hard to say in terms of figures, exact figures, because sociological research, independent one, does not exist in Belarus. And basically, the last organization was shut down in 2016, if I'm not mistaken, so many years ago. In 2015, I would say, when we had a previous election, presidential election, he might have won. His support was probably not that high, as he, you know, likes to present, not 80% or more than 80%. But people were scared because of Ukraine, because of Crimea, because of the war, and there were no protests. So basically, you can kind of say that people, whether people support him or not, if they protest or not. So in 2010, there were mass demonstrations after the elections, and there was also violence, and many people were arrested. Then in 2015, people did not kind of express their discontent, but it changed quickly, because the last poll that independent sociological research organization showed was actually that he had only less than 40% of support. And since then, no research exists, and basically we don't have numbers, but we can see that people, like, this discontent with poverty and mismanagement and kind of dissatisfaction with the authorities on different levels, and leader, president himself, has been on the rise. And in the past years, there were waves of protests which were largely ignored, I think, by neighboring countries, by the world. But it just shows that people, that there was dissatisfaction, there was dissent. And what happened last summer is just kind of the last straw, or the just kind of the most visible sign of it, right? Because that just existed. And what happened last summer, there is a full list of reasons why people were dissatisfied with Lukashenko and with his government. It started, kind of the last straw for many people was the how the government fought with COVID-19. There were this, headlines across the world about Lukashenko, who came up with this brilliant idea to cure the coronavirus with a tractor and vodka and sauna. And kind of many people laughed, obviously, at that. But it was not that funny in Belarus, you know, when people saw that hospitals are not prepared, hospitals are full, doctors don't have any protective equipment, and people just die. And moreover, Lukashenko, media, his government are just hiding the real figures, real statistics, and many people were scared. And when you kind of have a real picture, right, which you face, and then you have this kind of beautiful image on state TV that shows that everything is fine, don't panic, people kind of get angry. And again, there have been many more reasons. The stagnating economy, a financial crisis, kind of this general tiredness of Lukashenko, because, well, he has been in power for so long, and not really has changed in the past decade. He has been promising this $500 salary for 10 years, and basically that's kind of his usual promise, right? And people are just tired, like, well, we want to have more. There is this generational change, and kind of people just see that other countries develop better, develop faster, and they have they want to have the same in their country, and they were just, you know, so unhappy with what was happening. Also, the country, this is
unlike Russia, people do have a clear image of how things are going in neighboring and other countries.
Well, they travel a lot to Poland and Lithuania. They have, I think, the highest number of Schengen visas per capita in Europe, perhaps. But, like, they people often travel, people often work there. There are students who study in Poland and Lithuania, and they do compare. And when I traveled before the elections, when I wanted to understand, you know, what has changed and why this society is so mobilized, is so politicized, people were, even the elderly, unlike in Russia, and that's what Irina mentioned, I'm not perhaps that much aware of this age groups among protesters, but in Belarus there are all kind of age groups protesting on the streets, from the elderly to youngsters. And those elderly people were telling me that, well, we want our children and grandchildren to live in Belarus. We don't want them to, you know, look for their happiness somewhere abroad. So yes, people did travel. People had people study. People work abroad. People had all these different programs. In the U.S., you know, this kind of development programs when they just went to get some internship, whatever, to Europe or the U.S. So they would gain this experience and they would come back and they would see that they don't have so many opportunities in their country and they wanted this to change.
Irina, is that like we're talking about awareness when you're in Russia, but do Russian people travel less outside of the country, or do so because they don't seem to have the same understanding of what's happening outside?
Oh well, first of all, Russia is really huge compared to
Belarus.
So you
can travel inside the country.
You can travel inside the country, or it's not like you can get on the car and drive to Poland.
Right. Right.
Okay. Yeah, it takes long time. It takes actually even from Moscow, it takes going through Belarus first, and then you reach Poland. So Russians do travel, but you know, almost an anecdotal situation. A young couple here in Czech Republic, Russians, before COVID, tourists came here, sitting in the bar on Venceslav Square in the center of Prague, drinking Czech beer, and all of a sudden the guy, who is probably 25, is saying, you know what, an our beer is better. I don't know how this you know slogan of patriotism and Russian superiority over everybody else is affecting the taste receptors, but apparently it does. They love what they have. I don't understand anything about beer, even though I live in Czech Republic, but I heard that Czech beer is one of the best in the world, right?
Yeah. And it's really, it does feel like the little bit that I've had of interaction with Russia. I've been there a few times. I've, you know, my wife is very much, she speaks Russian. She likes the Russian culture very much. But there's certainly that sentiment that Russians feel, I don't know, like an exception. And, you know, it's very dangerous to make such sweeping generalizations, but since you're talking about this, I feel it's not completely inappropriate. But there is, and it might explain a little bit of that national centralism. There's this sentiment that the great Russian nation or empire is different from our. It's nationalism, I guess, but it seems ingrained in the Russian psyche.
It is, and that's very sad, actually, because you know, it's not only how Russians treat Europeans, like, oh, we are different, we are going our own way, and we don't need to be nice and fuzzy with you, but it's also how Russians treat each other. Which makes this society much more fragmented and much more difficult to be organized in common cause, not necessarily political, just common cause.
Yeah.
So that's you know, national character, but sometimes it's disappointing.
I think the real issue, and we can see this in any country that has a big nationalistic sentiment, including, you know, the U.S. In some respects, is that it clouds your judgment, it clouds your understanding of the situation. And I see this all the time when I speak. I have a lot of American guests on the show, and one of the most infuriating thing is that idea that the healthcare system should not, you know, national healthcare systems or better healthcare systems should not be implemented in the US because some people think that, you know, it couldn't work or it's different or it, and it's so plainly obvious to everyone else who doesn't have that view of things that is just inaccurate. And it seems like that is, to me at least, the most problematic thing with this sentiment is that it blinds you to the reality of how things are outside of your bubble that you put on a pedestal. And it seems like Belarus doesn't really have that issue. There's an awareness, from what I'm understanding from what you're saying, Hanna. In Belarus, there's an understanding of what the situation in Belarus itself is, for better or worse. Is that, and that's why now people are unhappy with how things are, and there's this wave of protests which hasn't stopped yet.
Well, there is genuinely, obviously, an understanding. Again, coming back to this, you know, pandemic, the first wave, people somehow knew that, you know, the situation was not that great as state media presented it, and that actually the coronavirus exists because Lukashenko has been ignoring it, and he's been saying that, you know, I don't see it, so it doesn't exist. So people knew, and it was actually thanks to independent journalists, social media, and bloggers, because they revealed this information, and that's why people trust independent media so much, and that's why actually people know what's happening. Mm. When Lukashenko was repeating these falsehoods about the coronavirus, it did not make people less worried, obviously. And then they turned to bloggers, and they turned to independent journalists, and even social media like Telegram. And that's why they kind of established a virtual monopoly over people's minds in a way. There was this, usually, before at least, state media played a huge role when it comes to how the information is being spread. But in the past years, distrust, I would say, in state media increased. So distrust increased, mm-hmm. And then we come to independent media, and then because of the pandemic, because of this kind of differences in figures in the information, people totally kind of turned to it, and it continued throughout the election campaign. And many people were telling me that, oh, we just do not watch the state TV, and that's right. A huge difference perhaps with Russia. Mm. I don't know if Irina agrees, but I think the latest kind of figures in this latest information that we got was that around 30% of people watch state TV in Belarus, but even less, some 20% would believe it. So that's right. Something that perhaps was not the case before, at least not to such extent that there is such a distrust. And at the same time, people just totally trust independent media.
Well, I would say that there are less and less Russians who watch and believe state TV as well. But unlike Belarus, Hanna, where, I'm sorry to say, but even the website of President Lukashenko doesn't open normally, Kremlin just really manipulate internet and social media. So the propaganda comes not from TV. For those who don't watch TV, it comes from the computer screen. Mm. So it's a much more complex and elaborated operation that Kremlin has compared to Lukashenko.
I would definitely agree. I think that the regime has totally lost the moment when they could take over social media, right? They did not invest in propaganda on the internet. So unlike in Russia. So that's why bloggers, that's why Telegram is so important, and you know, but there is control over internet. We have, I think there might be even more control because we have this state monopolist, Bell Telecom, that can, you know, easily switch off the internet. That's why there was a total blackout right after the election, And every Sunday in the kind of next months after the election on the 9th of August, the internet was switched off and people just did not have access. So it kind of, they're also controlling it, right? But they perhaps don't have enough money to invest in propaganda on social media, on the internet, though.
Okay, I do want to ask, we're reaching, quickly reaching the end of the discussion, but I want to ask a couple more things. And before I do, I want to ask you, Hanna, how do you see things evolving in Belarus? Because again, it's been protests, and there seems to be a strategy on Navalny's team in Russia that is very deliberate. I don't know how directed the protests are in Belarus. It seems like it's more grassroots movement. How do you see things evolving in the next few months or even longer?
Mm-hmm. So, yes, indeed, the protests are grassroots. They're very widespread. They involve basically all social professional age groups. In Belarus, now the format has changed because of the level of repression, because people cannot just gather. They're immediately dispersed and just, you know, arrested, put in prisons. So that's why people protest in their local neighborhoods. But I think kind of all fears, concerns that winter would stop the descent were wrong. People gather in their kind of districts because it's easier for them to disperse and kind of hide in their apartments. But it's good. It actually gives the people the kind of experience of horizontal connections, this very practical, very concrete self-organization on a local level. And Belarusians are just learning how to organize communities. And in the future, well, firstly, that's a basis for self-governance, but that's also something that would... people just meet each other. People just develop this trust. And if there is a trigger and if people are ready to come back to the streets, if the violence stops... because it's also very expensive to maintain this level of violence and repressions for the regime. So if there is a chance to protest again, people would do that because, well, whenever I speak with them, they just tell me that they are against, they are opposing Lukashenko and nothing has changed. They just have to be smarter and kind of more smarter in a way of how they maintain security, I would say. They just do not go openly and protest. They apply these guerrilla methods of showing, of how they show their discontent, but they're still ready. So I'd say that these, there is no way back. Unlike in previous years, unlike with previous protest movements, these would not stop, at least that easily. And it's just, whatever trigger appears, maybe the another wave of whatever financial crisis, poverty, or, whatever happens, like it might bring people again on the streets.
Okay. You know, that I'm realizing now that there would be an entire discussion to have about the actual situation in both countries and in similar countries and why people are led to these kinds of dangerous, for them, demonstrations and protests, and what the economic situation is, and beyond the freedom of information, because I think we, in our countries, we kind of take so many things for granted that we might have an image of these countries that is, okay, so you can't have the news you want on the TV, but does that really matter? The situation is much more serious, and maybe we will have an opportunity to discuss it, to discuss the reality of life in those countries in a future episode. But I do want to turn back the lens to, the Western world a little bit, and have your view, your opinion on how things have been happening in two areas. And we don't have to spend too much time on it, but very quickly, with the context of where you live and what you know, I'm curious what you think of two things. First, of course, the way the COVID pandemic has been handled in the West, because my experience when I talk to people from every single country is that everyone thinks their country has handled the pandemic the worst, and that it's unacceptable, and that it's horrible, and that things are completely dramatic. And that's my experience talking to people from every country I've spoken to. So that's one, what you think, how you think people have handled it, or, you know, Western countries have handled it. And the other question is, and it's going to be hard to summarize in a few sentences, but what do you think of President Trump's presidency and the character? Because a lot of people, especially, of course, on the right, have been saying, you know, he's a tiny dictator, and if he could, he would, essentially. Of course, he can't because the system is resilient, as we've seen in the U.S., but it wasn't just for play. Like, if he was in a situation where he would probably have gone as far as he could in less democratic manipulations. And I'm curious if, you know, I don't think we'll ever know, even though the last days of his term were very concerning in that aspect. But I'm curious to know how you both see it. So maybe let's go to Irina about COVID and about Trump, if you can summarize. I know it's a hard task.
Two things here. In terms of Russia, COVID, I think Putin handled COVID very, very well. First of all, he gave extra powers to local authorities to deal with the situation, which was very smart in two ways. It's more or less the same in the US that in Russia, where the states had a say in what measures they take. And because the territory is so big and because the situation in different regions with COVID is different, that's a smart thing to do, consider measures that are applicable to the situation on the spot. So that was first smart move. Second, why it was smart, it's because it took responsibility from Putin to the local authorities. So he was not blamed for whatever was going on in the country, like Lukashenko was, for example, for denying COVID, because he was not responsible. It's the local governments, local authorities that were responsible. And so that was good for him, but also it was good, actually, for people, for the country itself. In terms of the country where I live, Czech Republic, I think that Czech Republic at the beginning was the best. Actually, it was the best in Europe. It was fantastic how last spring, when people saw what's moving on us here from Italy and from Austria, it was unbelievable how people organized and really imposed very strict measures on themselves, primarily, with keeping social distance, with keeping themselves at homes, staying at homes. And Czech Republic actually fought the first wave of pandemic fantastically, quickly. And there were only 300 deaths from the first wave. Now, I don't know what happened during the summer and what got into the minds of people, but I see right now that the government doesn't know what to do. People actually don't care. Nobody sanitizes hands when they walk into the supermarkets, for example. Everything is closed. We live in complete lockdown, including the geographic lockdown. Like I, for example, I live outside Prague and I cannot go to Prague right now because of the lockdown measures that requires us to stay in our villages and regions. But it's just a disaster. Right now, it's a disaster. And I can tell you that I know what I'm speaking about, because Czech Republic is the worst in Europe right now in terms of the rate of the new infections on 100,000 people of the population. Terrible. Yeah, I can blame everybody.
Okay.
Not only the government, but also people
the
around.
People, yeah. I think
don't care.
A lot of people are quick to blame either the government or the people in every country. I think the reality is probably in between. There's blame to go around everywhere, but and also it's a difficult situation. But all right, and what about Trump then?
In terms of Trump, well, my husband is American and Republican.
Okay.
And we prefer not to discuss American politics at home.
Okay, maybe you don't have to. You don't have to say anything. I don't want to create issues in your marriage.
No, but on a serious note, you know, Trump made a lot of good things for the country. I mean, really, economically, the United States went through COVID pandemic that led to so many countries to, you know, economic collapse and decline. It's not the case for the U.S. Economically, the United States actually went through pandemic, I think, because of Trump's measures. Okay. Very, very well. So that's one side of Trump's administration. The other side that you were talking about is mostly political and, I would say, ideological, even to some extent, even though I don't like this word. For me personally, I was a little bit ashamed when the U.S. president, or a little bit is not correct word, I was ashamed when the U.S. president said that press is enemy of the people. Because primarily because I'm Russian, and because this phrase was used by Stalin, and for me to explain how can a leader of the major democracy in the world say something like this to a Russian person who would like Russia to be a part of the world and a part of the democratic society of the world is very, very difficult. So for me, it was just, frankly, horrible when I heard it. And that's what I will remember about Trump's years in the office forever.
All right. Hannah, what about you for COVID and Trump, the two wonderful topics that we have discussed over the past few years?
Yeah, and then like one hour later, we're still discussing it, right? Like,
yeah.
It's just an endless, I would say, topic. I'll just briefly add, because I think it's kind of clear, we all, well, Rina already explained what you know, how the pandemic was also perceived, I think, in our countries, and how we saw the situation developing abroad. The only thing I would like to add, because while many people were obviously dissatisfied and criticized their governments for how they handled the pandemic, but what was interesting in Belarus, it's actually the comparison. There was this, I'm a big fan of sociological research, apparently, but there was this excellent kind of data that showed that Belarusians assessed their government's reaction to the pandemic and then the handling of the pandemic as one of the most insufficient in the world. So they kind of you know, compared it, and they just were, I think Turkey was the first one and then Belarus. So it's just kind of interesting to see that Belarusians you know, were completely unhappy and just saw that their leadership is indifferent and incompetent, which was true. When it comes to obviously, and propaganda uses it. I see all the time how state media, you know, publish data about from other countries that, oh, these many people died, this many people got infected here and you know, in Poland and Lithuania and the US, and they are really happy to describe problems around the world and challenges that those countries are facing. But it's just interesting, they do not kind of reveal the real information about their country and about the statistics in Belarus. And when it comes to Trump, I would say that whatever happened in the U.S. Gave a reason to Lukashenko to, again, kind of deploy his propaganda, right, and to say that, you know, you see the problems in the U.S., but we are a stable country and it's all fine here and we really care about our people and so on. And when there were, you know, this incident, I would say, when people wanted to
The attack on the capital.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry, I'm forgetting words. It was also used by Lukashenko. He said that, oh, you see, the repressions in Belarus are not that bad. You see what's happening in the U.S.? And I would never allow the same to happen in Belarus. So I would never allow people to attack the government building, which actually never happened in Belarus. The protests were peaceful. He also kind of mentioned, Lukashenko mentioned the election results in the U.S. and kind of all these conspiracy theories that the election was rigged. And he was saying that, oh, you see, they also have, you know, questions about the election results and so on. So it's just kind of, this is to show that whatever happens around the world, whatever problems the world has, and, you know, it's just been completely kind of misused and misinterpreted and miscommunicated to, state media by Lukashenko and to Belarusians.
It really seems like one of the more lasting damages beyond the partisan rhetoric or partisan fighting in the U.S., the lasting damage that Trump has done is the image of the U.S. and the way it's being used outside of the U.S. Certainly my image of the U.S. has changed, and it will take a lot to change it back, I think. And I'm sure it's the case for many people. All right. Well, thank you very much to both of you for agreeing to spend a little bit of time with me and with us. Before we go, would you mind telling the listeners where they can find more about what you do and maybe your Twitter accounts, if you use Twitter? That's what we usually link to in the show notes. Irina, can you let us know?
Well, I have two Twitter accounts on my phone, I would recommend not to go to my personal, because I'm not using it that much, but to go to Radio Svoboda Twitter or RFERL, Twitter in English. And basically RFERL reflect everything that goes on in our countries, not only in Russia, but all over the former Soviet Union and Iran and Pakistan and Afghanistan. So it's RFERL.org. The website, and Twitter, RFERL.
It's, sorry, RFERL, yes.
Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.
Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Thank you very much. The link will be in the show notes, of course. Hannah, what about yourself?
Yeah, so I publish at the Atlantic Council, so you can also find my articles there on their website. And my Twitter is Hanna Lyubakova, which is my name and last name, and you can easily find it.
Excellent. It will also be, of course, in the show notes. Thank you to both of you. For me, it's Not Patrick on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, etc., etc. You can find all the links to everything I do on notpatrick.com. And that includes the Patreon for the Phileas Club, patreon.com/thePhileas Club. The link is also in the show notes. If you wish to support what I do here, then you can become a patron and support the show financially. And I thank everyone who already does. Thank you again, both. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And we'll be back hopefully soon. I do have a second child coming in a couple of weeks, so I don't know what's going to happen in April. It's going to be crazy. But I'll do my best to be back very soon. And thanks, everyone, for listening. Talk to you soon. Bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.